Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. Earlier this week, the federal government announced it would be spending $162 million over the next 4 years to implement a national action plan to end gender-based violence in Ontario. The timing is not by chance. November 25th is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. The month of November is Women Abuse Prevention Month. On today's show, we dig deep into intimate partner violence. The recent inquest into the deaths of Gladys and Bill Ryan is our topic. In 2017, Gladys was shot in the head in the emergency department while she was being treated in Northumberland Hills Hospital. Bill died of multiple gunshot wounds after police arrived. Nancy Johnson, CEO of Cornerstone Family Violence Prevention Center, attended the inquest in late September and early October. Gladys was known to her. Johnson will discuss intimate partner violence among elderly women. She will also go over the recommendations from the inquest and what changes they can bring. I'm so pleased to have with me today Nancy Johnson, CEO of Cornerstone Family Violence Prevention Center. Welcome to Consider This Northumberland.
Thanks for having me, Robert. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Back in 2017, there was a shooting at Northumberland Hills Hospital involving an elderly couple, Gladys and Bill Ryan. Were you aware at that time that this incident involved intimate partner violence?
Yes.
Do you remember your reaction when you learned the details of what took place?
I do. Actually, it was, I think we were at a board. I think we were doing a board planning day. And when I heard about it, I learned of the woman's name. And one of the first things that we did was, you know, is she a client of ours? And we looked into that. That's usually our first reaction. And I think a reaction that all violence against women agencies share, because not only is it a tragedy, we also have to worry about impact of on staff and all sorts of other things that you need to consider. So when I heard about it, and I learned details that it was a woman shot by her husband, I knew exactly what it was. Now the details we didn't have, and when we talked about it being a femicide, I think we got some pushback of saying, well, it's under investigation. And I said, well, here's what I do know is that a woman was shot by her husband. So, I didn't even really know how to answer that other than a woman was shot by her husband. And this is something that we see far too often, right? The femicide list, and we get it every month through our association. So there's been 46 femicides since November 26, 2022 in Ontario alone. So yeah, it's femicides are on the rise in Ontario, and we're seeing that. And we all need to be concerned about that, because that is the most serious part of this issue of gender-based violence, is that it can lead to that. And far too often it does. It was a sad sort of reflective day.
Elderly women experience higher levels of violence according to a national statistic collected by police. The Center for Research and Education on Violence Against Women and Children say that most of the attention when looking at intimate partner violence focuses on younger women. Older women are almost invisible. What is your experience?
Yeah, I think one of the trends that we're seeing, and each year when there is a femicide, There is a domestic violence death review committee that looks at every femicide and makes recommendations. So separate from a coroner's inquest, because most femicides do not ever end up in a coroner's inquest. I was shocked and amazed when we were preparing for the inquest here with the Ryan inquest, that I think there's only been 5 coroner's inquests related to domestic violence in Ontario. I mean, I was just like, oh my goodness, like, I live this reality all the time, but sometimes things like that, regardless of how many years I've been doing it, I'm still shocked. I think for older women, Robert, one of the things that we hear about with older women and from what studies are showing is that there is that generational piece, that, you know, the way that women were raised in those generations was those terrible, you know, words and phrases that many women live by. You know, you made your bed, you lie in it. You know, these sorts of things are private matters. And there's, you know, elements of shame and blame. There's also a distinct difference with financial considerations. We know right now that, you know, we know about the housing crisis. So women leaving their matrimonial home can be it's an extra barrier for many older women. And we also know with, you know, with the Ryan inquest, there was a level of dependence that she had on her partner because she, you know, she was facing some decline in her health and her cognitive well-being. So we also see that as, you know, a distinct barrier and a serious risk and one that gets overlooked.
I'd like to come back to the Ryan inquest in just a little bit, but I want to explore this a little bit further. What do you see locally? Is there a bias? We as a community tend to look at intimate partner violence through the lens of younger women, or do we have a more balanced approach? Can you maybe characterize how we as a community view this?
Mm-hmm. I think there is an invisibility to this issue. We certainly see at Cornerstone, we have seen women in their 80s reach out to service for us. But by and large, there is an invisibility to this. So the idea of, you know, having a spotlight on this doesn't happen regularly because we don't talk about it. We don't recognize it. We don't acknowledge that this can be happening. And for many women who have been in the same intimate partner relationship for upwards of 50 years, Robert, I think most people are probably turning a blind eye to it and not acknowledging it. So I think there are some significant biases around this, and older women have not a lot of power in our society. You know, they become invisible in so many ways in our society. As we age, we become invisible. And I think women who are experiencing gender-based violence and other oppressions, I think that that's a significant issue.
Are there differences in the factors contributing to the violence against older women as compared to younger women?
Robert, when we look at elder abuse, right, and there's been some work on elder abuse, it's not always an intimate partner. It can be a family member. Particularly around financial risk. We can see it in caregivers, unfortunately. It's across the board. I think the one that perhaps we have the most confusion with is the intimate partner violence.
We don't think about it. We always think about it in terms of partners,
yeah,
and partner relationships, and not necessarily about caregivers that can create problems or family members creating problems. In your experience, how often does this occur, and do people come to you looking for support and help?
Sometimes they do, Robert. Yeah. And sometimes we have seen women have experienced with both their partner as well as their children or caregivers. So yes, we have definitely seen that. Again, I think there is a hesitancy for women to reach out. I think there's barriers to women reaching out. I think there's a significant level of shame and blame that women, older women in particular, carry. Shame and blame is something that we see across the board, regardless of age, for women to come forward to admit this is happening because they feel like they're to blame. You know, all of those things that we've been, you know, working on for decades, it's still very real. And shame and blame, it plays a very big part of women not reaching out. And then when we have people who don't ask, you know, I'm like, if you don't ask, women aren't telling you, you know? So I think it's really important that, you know, when women are accessing service through, you know, through other agencies, that we're asking the question, because very few women are going to say it, right? I'm coming to see my doctor because I have a headache, but I have a headache because I'm so stressed out because I'm being abused. And very few people make the linkages, right? We're still looking for, you know, women who have obvious signs of physical trauma, right? And it's, you know, again, we continue to say that's one element, but it's not the only element. And we know that women are killed by their intimate partner oftentimes, and there's no physical violence that happens. So, you know, staying so focused on the physical violence, I think is a concern. And I think sometimes that's what we're seeing with senior women as well. That it's not necessarily just the physical violence, right? That things can unravel very quickly and people don't notice the signs and symptoms like the Ryans. And something so tragic like this occurs.
Let's talk about the inquest. What was the role of Cornerstone in the inquest?
We were invited to attend. So I attended every day at the inquest. It was a virtual inquest. And listened. I wasn't allowed to, you know, ask questions of any of the witnesses. At the end, I was allowed to offer a submission and offer recommendations to the coroners. To the coroner's counsel, sorry, that was the proper word for the lawyers in this, to which we did. So it was really important that we were there every day, that we were there as the reminder of what happened in this circumstance. It was a little bit different than some of the other coroner's inquests. There wasn't any family members of the Ryans present. There were many lawyers and myself. I was the only non-lawyer there, other than, of course, the jury, who were a lovely, you know, a great attentive jury members who were really engaged, who showed up day after day to hear some really difficult things. And I was there, too. And I was pleased that they included us because, you know, it might not have been. Again, they had to have the coroner's inquest because, you know, Mr. Ryan was killed by Coburg police officers, again, responding like no blame at all. But, you know, when it hit the coroner's desk, I think they looked at it and went, there's a big overlay here of intimate partner violence. So that's when they reached out to us in the summer to say, hey, would you be willing to attend? So we did that. We thought it was important that we were there as a voice and not lose that sight of it. And yeah.
I'd like to work my way through some of the recommendations, not all of them, but a few that I think are relevant to our conversation. One of the interesting recommendations involved the ability of triage nurses or doctors being able to access information regarding abuse. How is this useful?
I think a lot of what came out of the inquest was the sharing of information and how information gets shared and relayed. You know, it was just such a critical piece of what occurred, right? Of, you know, the paramedics and who was telling somebody what. And so, yeah, it was a lot about information sharing and gaps in information sharing. And I think not only this inquest, but pretty much every other inquest involving the death of women at the hands of a partner, it's a blaring piece of the inquest in terms of information sharing with organizations. So whether that's healthcare, police, organizations like Cornerstone, Children's Aid, like there's been many, many, many pieces of this that show up in every inquest, as well as at all the domestic violence death review committees. Information sharing comes up time and time again.
In that case, then, why is it not happening? What are the barriers that don't allow you to share the information that you have with our local hospitals, our police, our fire? Why isn't that happening?
I think it's a great question, Robert, and one that I hear particularly with health. And again, health has other privacy rules that we do. We're not under those rules, but certainly information like privacy comes up time and time again. I'm not saying that I agree with it. I think it can sometimes get in our way. And what we've talked about is, when does privacy, when does sort of, serious risk of harm overrule privacy? And I know that, at Cornerstone, we're really clear about that, right? We'll talk to women about her confidentiality, but when we have to not honor that confidentiality, here are the reasons why. An imminent risk to yourself or others is one of them. So I don't really have the answers to that, Robert, in terms of what gets in the way of, say, our local hospital or some of the other health sector. But that's what I have heard for sure is around privacy and yeah.
Well, it's funny because many of the recommendations surround changes to the hospital procedures, making them more conscious and monitoring the situation where intimate partner violence was a factor. So has Cornerstone been working at all with Northumberland Hills Hospital or Campbellford Memorial Hospital to address this? I mean, are you guys even talking about it?
It's something that we're going to be doing in the future for sure. In 2018, after this event occurred, we did have a couple of meetings with Northumberland Hills Hospital looking at, protocols, because one of the questions that I have asked, and it, it came up again at the inquest, was, are you triaging, like, is part of your triaging asking women about experiencing intimate partner violence, regardless of what they're coming in for at the hospital? Because I maintain a perfect gateway to help is our healthcare sector. Because most women at some point in their life touch the healthcare sector. And I think it's, I've been quite vocal about this. I think we receive very few referrals from our healthcare sector. So there's a lot of work to do. I've made a commitment. Cornerstone has made a commitment to try to, again, make more inroads with our healthcare sector. I'm hoping that the recommendations will allow us to pave that road a little bit more smoothly. I think that there's willingness. I do. I have to believe in there being willingness to, to do this. And we've talked about one of the recommendations that we had was about hospitals across the province developing a robust protocol with their local hospitals to address this issue. And one of the things that we talked about is, you don't have to have all the answers. Like, that's what we can do. But you have to recognize what some of the risk factors are and refer, right? Because I've often said, like, we can come in and provide service. We're happy to do that. And in fact, that's a great thing to do because our staff are really well trained in looking at risk factors, responding, developing safety plans. That's what we're real good at. And, I think we can work collaboratively together and we can provide training, because that was certainly the other resounding thing that came out of the inquest is a lack of training in the healthcare sector around intimate partner violence. I was surprised to hear that the nursing schools, there are no mandatory trainings around intimate partner violence. There's nothing for PSWs. which again, you know, PSWs can be the eyes and ears for particularly older women or women who face, you know, multiple barriers and, you know, are needing that level of service. They can be the eyes and ears in these homes or care facilities. And that's important. And again, that's, you know, no fault on nurses or PSWs, and they do a heck of a good job. But it is just, you know, giving people a little bit of information, and it doesn't have to be cumbersome, because again, I know everybody has to do training and it's super busy work. But we're happy to work together. And I think we need to, like, we all know that this is the way we have to work together these days. Now more than ever, we're all stretched thin and we have to work collaboratively. And again, with, you know, not pointing fingers, it's how can we have the best outcomes? How can we ensure that there's never another Ryan Inquest in our community?
There was a recommendation to declare intimate partner violence as an epidemic, and I'm sure that's not news to you. But what is your reaction to that recommendation?
Yeah, well, it's been interesting across our sector about that, because it was quite specific. The recommendation is for the provincial government to declare intimate partner violence an epidemic, which they haven't done yet. A number of communities are doing that at the municipal level, but the province hasn't done it yet. Today, though, I have to say to you, Robert, and I didn't have a chance to send this to you, but the government of Canada and Ontario signed the bilateral agreement on the National Action Plan today. So the National Action Plan has been in the works, as you know, for years. And in November 2022, the federal government said, okay, we're ready to do this. It's a 10-year federal plan. We've never had a National Action Plan ever, which is just, again, like, crazy to me. So the province, Ontario, has signed the bilateral agreement as of this morning. What that means for Cornerstone, I don't know yet. But I do know that some of the recommendations that we fed our association, some of the words seem to be in the media release. So I'm thinking, I'm hoping that they've listened to us. One of the things that we have said in Ontario and probably across Canada is adequately fund the programs and services you already have. Don't make us create new and innovative solutions, right? That we were required to do forever and made us all crazy. Going, what we're doing right now is really good, solid stuff that many of us have been doing, like Cornerstone, 35 years. We know what we're doing. We need the money to do it so that we're not having to raise upwards of $500,000 or $1 million every year to just keep the lights on. So I'm really hoping that, you know, the investment of the federal money through the province is going to hopefully elevate some of those funding streams. They also talked about prevention, which again is something that we've been talking about forever. Of funding prevention initiatives. What exactly that's going to mean, I don't know. So the media release just happened today, again, in alignment with November being Women Abuse Awareness Month, Prevention Month. So that was good. Arrived across my desk, sent it out to staff to say, this is good news. Don't know what it means, but this is the first time. And, you know, we knew when it came down, the National Action Plan came down, we all did a bit of a groan, because they were like, okay, so now you all have to go and make bilateral agreements with the federal government. So we're like, oh my goodness, we never saw that coming. And it certainly wasn't a recommendation from us, you know, at a national level, because we were like, this is just going to slow everything down. So I was quite happy to see that it was a year. I know it was a year. I was worried it might be longer. So we'll see what happens, right? Going to celebrate the small wins. It's another step of actually having a national action plan and actually some money attached to the implementation of the national action plan in Ontario. So that was a hallelujah moment today.
If you could leave listeners with one takeaway from this inquest and your insights, what would that be?
I think the importance of working together. I think there is an opportunity in working more closely with the healthcare sector. And again, what I continue to come back to is many women don't reach it to Cornerstone because they don't know the way here. And if it's as simple as they see their doctor or they're at the ER or they are delivering a baby at Northumberland Hills Hospital or Campbellford, and they know that we're here because people tell them and people ask them a question, or people notice something not quite being there or something is off, you know, that they find their way here. And I think we need to do that. We need to do that together, and we need to break down the silos and work together effectively. So that's something we're really committed to doing. And I hope and I believe that we have partners in the community who are also willing to do that with us.
Nancy Johnson, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Robert. I appreciate it.
That was Nancy Johnson, CEO of Cornerstone Family Violence Prevention Center. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.